Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to Kildare's KFM. It is Tuesday, the 24th of October, and it's Caoimhe Hearney here with you until 3. Coming up first on today's show, we'll speak to Thomas McCann, founder of the Traveller Counselling Service, because a new report found that 11% of travellers die by suicide, 7 times higher than the general population. At 2:20, Lars Gabelski will tell us about the day service in Naas, which is holding 2 events next week. Dr. Natalie Cole, Head of Innovation at Tallaght University Hospital, will be telling us about Innovate Health inventing a new device for kidney patients at Tallaght University Hospital that now allows them to have dialysis at home. And lastly, we'll be hearing from a doctor that is nicknamed the Health Hacktivation Doctor or the Longevity Concierge about how stress can affect different parts of the body. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can call in 045 898 999 and Hannah Kelly will answer your call. If you want to email me, it's studio@kfmradio.com, or of course you can send us in a WhatsApp or a text. 1 in 10 travellers are losing their lives to suicide. That's the findings of a new report from the Traveller Counselling Service, which is calling for an out-of-hours crisis phone line for the community. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Thomas McCann, founder of the Traveller Counselling Service. Good afternoon, Thomas.
Good afternoon.
Thomas, fairly stark figures coming out of this report.
Yeah, well, the figures around suicide, which is like 6 to 7 times higher in the travel community than it is in the settled population, was actually identified in 2010 in the All-Ireland Travel Health Study. So actually many would believe that within the community, certainly, and maybe others as well, that it's actually higher now than it was then, you know. So them figures is from the All-Ireland Travel Health Study in 2010.
Okay, so 13 years old, and many believe that the situation has gotten worse. Tell us then about, I suppose, some of the struggles that the travelling community have in terms of trying to access support, and then just generally their day-to-day struggles in life that maybe people within the settled community don't understand or don't experience.
Yeah, well, there's a number of barriers that was identified for travellers in terms of, like, you know, certainly, and this, there was a piece of work done in 2017 by the Community Foundation Ireland, and people can have a look at their website and get the research from that. But in that, there was a number of barriers that was identified. Certainly, racism and discrimination was a key barrier, where I think it was about 40% of the participants had experienced discrimination in the health services, you know. And, you know, that would have been across the board, and felt that certainly travel culture wasn't respected or taken into account.
In the health service?
In the health service, you know.
Okay.
The other thing is, and it has been identified since 2006 at the Vision for Change, is the lack of culturally appropriate and inclusive mental health services. And that was there for a long time and is now in the current strategy shared in the vision, but it has been there for a long time, identified for a very long time, that is a factor, you know, kind of impacting on the kind of services that as a barrier in terms of travellers accessing certainly mental health. But then there's also stigma within the community as well, which is can act as a barrier and has acted as a barrier in terms of individuals going for help when they need it. And that what that happens in that case is that it can be let go until it becomes a crisis, you know, and that's unfortunate. And the sort of stigma is another, you know, factor. Now, there's many other barriers as well, but they're some of the key ones that emerged in recent times in terms of research.
You hear a lot about, you know, travellers, you know, needing X, Y and Z. And sometimes within government or maybe a lot of the talk can focus around, you know, housing travellers and, you know, getting them this. I think that people forget that, like, travellers want to keep their cultural identity. They don't necessarily want to be housed. Would I be right in saying that, Thomas? If there was a way that they could live their authentic life in the country and have the infrastructure there for it, they would be happy to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, kind of, you know, certainly accommodation is a key factor and has been for a very long time.
Okay.
And culturally appropriate accommodation, because as many people and many of our listeners will probably know, that the extended family is a very important part of traveller culture. You know, and so accommodating family, traveller culture, and that's kind of that hasn't been done appropriately in terms of, if you look at kind of local authorities who hasn't spent the budgets that was set down to them in previous years when there was a lot of, when there was money there, you know, while at the same time many sites has become overcrowded. You know, you then have the anti-trespass legislation, which prohibits nomadism, really. It criminalises nomadism. So travellers can't really travel anymore. You know, they can't kind of, you have 48 hours or your caravan will be confiscated. And that's happened. That's only been used against travellers, as far as I'm aware. So what's happened in all of that is that it has kind of forced many travellers to try and get under private rented accommodation, into private rented accommodation. Now, if you look at how hard it is for even people who are in a position to kind of, you know, well, I won't say in a position, but who's employed, say, for instance, and who's, you know, in a better position than many travellers would be, and who's finding it hard to get private rented accommodation. But then if you take the discrimination into account on top of that, what you have now is you have an increased number of travellers becoming homeless. And that has been increasing year on year, you know, as a result of the housing policy and the legislation that's been put in place, particularly in relation to travellers.
Okay. I suppose, you know, sometimes people, like, we get a lot of messages in here, and again, like, you know, it's like anything, it's not all travellers and it's not all men or women,
yeah,
you know, different things like that. But definitely within the Kildare area, you know, we would get a lot of messages about illegal encampments. I have seen the photos and I have seen the way that areas have been left after, whether it be travellers or just general illegal encampments. And I think this plays into, you know, society's view that if they were to allow, say, travellers come on their land or whatever, that the place is going to be left a certain way. Would you agree with that, Thomas? And you can see where some, and it's not all, but some may give the others a bad name.
No, I mean, you know, kind of, I can't talk for the whole community, and, like, I mean, you know, kind of, I can't represent the views of the whole community.
Absolutely.
And I can only represent kind of my own experience of being involved in community development and as a traveller myself for the last 40 years in terms of travel rights and looking at the conditions on the ground for travellers, that in many cases, the structure isn't put in place for people to do that in a proper way, like, I mean, in terms of, and, you know, in some cases, areas, I know, like, if you look at the trespass, anti-trespass legislation, that came on the back of a situation where it was promoted to kind of in south side of Dublin, for instance, as a result. But the local authorities kind of, if you look at that against the local authorities not providing the proper infrastructure when they had the money and when they were given the money and when there was a lack of spend. Now, if people want to check this out, they can look at the Human Rights and Equality Commission evaluation of local authorities, and they've looked at all the local authorities. So you can look at what Kildare spent from that pot that was there, and it was millions. It was in the tens of millions, actually.
Okay.
And many local authorities didn't draw down any of that money.
At all. Okay.
You know?
And that was to support, like, infrastructure for the travelling community.
Specifically for travel accommodation.
Okay.
You know, and, like, so when you look at that against that, you see that, look, people were travelling, but, and of course, no, you know, if you go on to many of the sites don't have rubbish where there's proper infrastructure in place. So you don't have that situation, you know?
Okay.
You don't have the same situation. So now, that's not to take away, like, as I say, I can't talk for the whole community. And, of course, every community, there's, you know, diversity in it. And so, you know, but at the same time, I really think that we have to look at what infrastructure has been put in place to support people to camp properly and to kind of, you know, and not have them conditions where you, where that that does generate division and does generate anger and resentment.
Absolutely. Moving back then, I suppose, to why you're on today, and I suppose the mental health within the travelling community, it says here that 89.7% of the travelling community said they were worried about suicide within the community.
Absolutely. Like, it's a national crisis. And I mean, that's the only way I can describe it now. From all the, like, we can go back. One of the first reports that was conducted in terms of traveller and travellers and suicide was a report carried out by a woman called Mary Rose Walker in 2003. And at that stage, it was identified that suicide in the travel community was two to three times higher than in the settled community. And, you know, right up to 2010, then, is that the All-Ireland Travel Health Study that identifies it. That was a national study, and that was carried out, an in-depth national study, and by UCD. So it's an independent study, and had a number of travellers involved in it from different local areas around the country, where it was six to seven times higher. And you can see that year on year, the mental health crisis has been building and building and building. And many travellers, and indeed other organisations, and many settled people as well, has been trying to push for a proper structures for travellers that's impacting on traveller health and mental health. And so far, that hasn't really happened. It really hasn't happened. And of course, if you're living in a situation where you're unemployed, like 84% unemployment in the community or thereabouts, where your accommodation is really bad, where you're in overcrowded conditions, where you're facing discrimination on a regular basis, of course your mental health is going to be affected by these conditions,
Absolutely.
And so, we really need to look at, as a society, where do we want to, where are we going? How are we doing this? And there's much better ways of doing it. And I think we need real collaboration and partnership. And we need support of a settled community to do this as well,
Yeah, one participant in the study commented, Thomas, to say that, can you get me a nice home? Can you get me a job? Can you get people to stop treating us like dirt on their shoes? And if the answer to these things is no, then nothing will change. A counselling session won't solve these problems for travellers. My brother took his own life. If I had the chance to talk him out of it, what hope would I have offered him?
Yeah, well, there's two things there. One is, and they're right in one way, the social determinants or the conditions that people are in and the opportunities in life will impact on mental health and will continue to kind of impact negatively if they're not addressed. And that is very much there. But the other side of that then is people who are have mental health difficulties and who need access to proper services and need to have a choice and an opportunity to engage in a proper and structured way, in a culturally appropriate way, with the services when they are there. Because many people are trying to reach out and are looking for help. And we know that from the Traveller Counselling Service across the country. We're a community-based counselling service. And through COVID, we had to go online and by phone, which opened it up to the whole country. And now we're seeing people in the service from 16 or 17 different counties. So people are reaching out for help. Okay. And that help needs to be there. One side of it is, and there's a lot of campaigns around the need to talk, the people need to talk. Mm. But having done that, when people do want to talk and are ready to talk, the services need to be there that's going to meet them.
Absolutely.
And, encourage them to come. I mean, a lot of people are going to A&E. Now, I'm not only talking here about the traveller community.
The general community.
Going to A&E when you have severe mental health difficulties and you're sitting there for 14 or 15 hours. Now, I know everybody else has to sit there as well, but with mental health difficulties, there needs to be structures put in place within the A&E service for people who have mental health difficulties, because it's also not appropriate for other patients there with other conditions and somebody with a serious mental health condition in the room with them, because it's not we need to look at how we manage them situations. And I'm not only talking about travellers in that situation. Okay. many people in that situation, you know? And we know of some of them who have left A&E and who took their own life as a result, you know?
And we'll yeah, which is absolutely shocking, but we'll come back to, I suppose, what this report is recommending for the traveller-led, state-supported crisis phone line. But just before we move on to that, in terms of that participant who said, you know, can you get me a nice home? Can you get me a job? Yeah. Just touching on the job thing and bringing it to education and the cultural, I suppose, culturally within the travelling community, is it still the cultural norm that girls would leave school around the ages of 16, or has that changed, Thomas? Is it changing? Because I would imagine that would be a barrier to, you know, a career or, you know, job prospects.
Yeah. No, that wouldn't be a cultural norm. Most families try to keep their children in school for as long as possible. And that's the, you know, across the board in most cases, in the majority of cases. Again, there'll be some families who might be, you know, kind of very traditional. And again, you can't talk for the whole community. But from my experience, most travellers, and any travellers I've talked to, and if you go out and talk to them yourself, Cleveland, locally there in Kildare, most families, the majority, 99% of families, will try and keep their children in school for as long as possible. But there's barriers and difficulties within that. One of the key things is that travel culture was never recognised within the school system. Travelling children, and myself included, never seen your own culture reflected in the curriculum. Never seen, you know, so there was no kind of support for travel culture within the school system in terms of traveler culture. But also then there's many other barriers involved in that. And we talked about the accommodation, of course. You know, kind of, it's very, very difficult when, you know, if you're living in an unofficial site and you don't have, or you're living in very overcrowded conditions and you don't have the conditions, you know, especially moving from primary to secondary. Primary school, you see, there's quite a high level of retention. But if children move into that, you know, and also there was a discussion there about preschool in terms of, you know, travellers going into preschool and making sure that they have the right foundation for when they move into secondary. Because, like, when you get to teenage years, there's insecurities around identity for all teenagers, you know, kind of. And, like, you know, to stand out and to kind of not feel that you're kind of at the same level, that's going to have a huge impact on your participation in the school system, you know. Okay. So I think there's many issues to address. I think, like, all the travel organisations, and certainly many of the families, encourage as much as possible their young people, both the men and the women, to stay in school for as long as possible. You know, and that's, you know, kind of...
Sorry, I just have to move on, Thomas, because I'm tight for time. But talk about the recommendation of the need for a traveller-led, state-supported crisis phone line. You want this 24/7, is it?
Well, that would be the ideal, you know, to have a 24/7. And, you know, kind of... But what we did in the research is we looked at... We had a number of focus groups around the country and a number of individuals were interviewed as well, travellers and then other service providers and providers of phone services, and looked at what might be the barriers for travellers, what might support travellers to engage, what would be the appropriate times if we didn't have a 24/7 line. And the key thing that came out is that it needed to be done in a collaborative way with another mainstream service provider, such as PA The House or the Samaritans. And we've had discussions with both PA The House and the Samaritans. And even with PA The House, that's looking very promising, you know. And there's a lot of support for it. At the launch yesterday, we launched the report yesterday. And there's a lot of support for it. And a lot of support for it within the community, because to have an out-of-hours phone service that somebody can call up and that is culturally appropriate would make a huge difference to people when they need that help or when their family is really concerned about, you know, about a member of their family, you know, about what to do or whatever. And I think that's, you know, that certainly from my perspective as a society, I think, not just for travellers, I think it's the least we can do to have a service available when people need to talk to somebody, you know, when they're in that level of crisis. You know?
Thomas, we'll have to leave it there. Thomas McCann, founder of the Traveller Counselling Service. They're calling for a traveller-led, state-supported crisis phone line for travellers because 1 in 10 travellers are losing their lives to suicide, 7 times higher than the general population. And of course, if you have been affected by any issue raised on the show today, you can contact Pieta House on 1-800-247-247, or the Samaritans can be contacted 24/7 on a free phone number 116123, or you can email the Samaritans at joe@samaritans.ie. Thanks very much to Thomas McCann.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hardy. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, day services in Naas are holding 2 events in the next week. I'm joined on the line now by Lars Skubalski, Director of Day Services at Resilience Healthcare. Good afternoon, Lars.
Hi, Caoimhe. How are you?
Very good, Lars. Tell us about the Naas Day Service launch. I know that's happening in November, but in the next couple of weeks, there's a few things happening.
That's right, Caoimhe. So look, we have 2 events planned for our day service in Naas. So tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. we have actually a family information evening. We have run those events last year in a couple of areas as well, and we're trying to run one in Kildare now this year. So it's a transition from school to adult disability day service. It's an open evening that is really for schools, families, young people that are leaving school and looking for a day service. And really what the information evening does is we are presenting and looking at pathway to services, and often families with young people that are coming out of school, they don't quite know what's happening next in their lives. So it is about looking at how people are referred to the HSC, how the HSC does their profiling and assessment, and how people then refer it on to providers like Resilience Healthcare.
Okay. So this would be for students maybe in sixth year who have just finished school or whatever, wherever they are, and they're leaving the second level education, entering the normal work world or whatnot. This is a transition way for them to find out what services they can avail of or what's out there for them.
Yeah, it is mainly catered for people with disabilities. So, for example, people with the learning disabilities, autism, and other areas of additional needs. You know, so a lot of people with disability attending mainstream schools, some of them attending special needs schools. But for a lot of them, the difficulties is to navigate where will I go from here, you know, and for families as well.
Okay.
So we're doing those information evenings to say, look, the pathway into day services, for example, Resilience Healthcare works this way, you know, and we're presenting from an HSC point of view how they're doing their profiling, all the way when referrals come to us, when we then meet with the families and doing transitions with young people into our services.
Okay, I have a message in here, Lars. Someone says, hi, can you please ask Lars, can you attend the information session in Naas if you have a son who has left school a few years ago but is still not receiving a service?
100%. You know, and look, we see a bit of that as well, you know. So it's people that are leaving school next year, but it's also people that are without a service. And it's also sometimes people attend rehabilitation training programs and they finish them. And then what is the next step for them? So some of the people that are doing RT programs, they're coming to us afterwards as well. You know, we're doing special skills building with those young people, you know, around independent living, getting people job ready. Sometimes it's just social skills, leisure activities. So it can be everything, really. You know,
okay.
It's individualized programs, all person centered. You know,
just for the Naas area, Lars, or is it open to, you know, the wider Kildare area?
So the information evening and the open day is for Kildare. But look, we also have sometimes people coming from wider areas. You know,
okay.
So our information, we have 2 day services in Kildare. One is in Naas and one is in Clane. The one in Naas tomorrow evening is holding that information evening. But when we were holding those meetings in Ennis in County Clare last week, we saw people coming from Tipperary, from Limerick, from other areas as well. So it was more for them to get the information, how does the process actually work to move from from school into the adult world.
Okay. Just for people who might want to attend that information evening tomorrow night, it's at the Unit 14B Poplar House in Naas, in Kildare, of course. W91HC5P is the air code there. You can also, you have to book a place, Lars, do you?
Look, it'd be good to book a place, right. But look, if people decide that evening to turn up, that's okay too, you know.
Okay.
So we have enough, like our service manager, Laura Rourke, if you want to call her or send her a WhatsApp on 086-068-4973. But also there's an opportunity to turn up on the evening if you decide short notice to attend the meeting. And look, our entrance is sometimes a bit difficult to find. It's actually, we're above permanent TSB.
In Naas.
Yeah, in okay. Naas, and also it's beside there's a coffee shop, P&S Roasters.
Oh, P&S Roasters,
yes. So it's right beside that. It's the entrance. There's a doorbell. There's a sign for resilience, you know, because I just know in the past sometimes people find it difficult to find it.
So okay. And just for people, that would be across from the Our Lady and St. David's Church in Naas, the big church in Naas, and St. Mary's Secondary School. Just quickly then on to the Naas Day Service launch, which would be on Wednesday, the 1st of November. That's going to be from 11 until 2. What's the difference there with that one then?
So... What the difference really is, like, we opened the Naas Day Service last year, you know, and we're just officially opening it. And what it is, it's inviting, again, potentially people that want to have a look at the service, but it's also for the wider community. If people are, you know, we're doing a lot of community integration with our young people, you know, they're attending gyms and, you know, looking for jobs, but it's also for maybe businesses nearby that want to know more about resilience and what we're doing. So it's a coffee morning. It's, you know, a bit of music, it's a bit of fun. It's, you know, we're answering any questions that people have on the day. But look, it's for local businesses, it's for people who's looking to use services, it's for everybody, really.
Okay. Just to give the information again before I let you go, tomorrow evening, the family information evening, transitioning from school to adult disability day services. It's happening in Naas, above permanent TSB in Naas, Unit 14B Poplar House. It starts at 6 p.m, Lars, isn't that it?
It's coffee and refreshments at 6, and the presentation will start at 6:30, you know,
okay.
And then look, we have afterwards, we have time to talk to people and answering any questions and so on and so forth, you know.
Okay.
Kriva, just look also, like, our day service, we also have a number of residential homes in Kildare as well, you know, and if people are interested in applying for jobs with us as well, with Resilient Healthcare, they can send their CVs to careers@resilience.ie.
Careers,
so look, just that, and an opportunity as well. Look, there's always, we're always looking for new talent, you know. So if people are interested in working with Resilience Healthcare, they can email careers@resilience.ie or send a CV to them.
Brilliant.
And we'll contact them directly then.
Brilliant. Lars Gabowski, Director of Day Services at Resilience Healthcare. Thanks very much, Lars, for joining us this afternoon. Now, Innovate Health have invented a new device for a kidney patient at Tala University Hospital. The device has enabled the patient to have dialysis at home so she could return to work. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Natalie Cole. She's Head of Innovation at Tala University Hospital. Good afternoon, Natalie.
Good afternoon, Cleva. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to have you, Natalie. Tell us about this device, because I imagine, you know, it's going to make huge strides for people suffering.
Yeah, so basically, just to give you a little bit of background, what we do here in Innovate Health, so we work with staff and patients with regard to ideas that they may have, with regard to some challenges that they may have with frontline staff and also with our patients. So basically what we look at is ideas that we can help support our staff to get over these barriers. So in this case, where we would have a very well-established renal unit here in Tyne University Hospital. And in that unit, we actually have specialised nurses which help patients to actually do home dialysis at home. And in this particular case, we had a patient who normally, when the home dialysis or dialysis be happening, the dialysis would actually be connected to, patient would be connected to a dialysis machine. And then we'd normally connect that to their non-dominant hand. But in this case, that was not possible. So basically, we had to actually have a connection to the to her dominant arm, which actually caused an issue then with regard to her being able to do dialysis at home.
Okay.
So what we did then is we worked with our designer to actually see if how we could overcome this. It's not certainly a device. It's really just a design bespoke solution. So really what it is a simple plastic holder. So basically what this does, it means that the patient can actually have that one hand free to actually be able to use the tubing that she needs to connect to her dialysis machine at home.
Okay.
So really it was a very simple solution, but an impact on it was basically for this particular patient quite impactful, because basically it means that she can actually do her home dialysis at home.
Okay. Would this be specific to this patient then, or would you
yes.
say that it would be? So you wouldn't be able to use it for other people then?
No. This is specifically for this particular patient. But I suppose what we do through innovation here in the hospital is that we look at these scenarios and be able to quickly go in within a short period of time with our designer and do a workaround for this. So we would have multiple projects. They would be some would be simple turnaround like this one particular, or others would be a larger, more transformative one in which they would actually be looking at an actual medical device. In this case, it was a solution that could be designed pretty quickly and bespoke for this particular patient.
Okay. Is this something that you would be looking at with all patients then, you know, the best ways to support them and make things as easy as possible for whatever kind of treatment they're having?
Exactly. So I suppose what we do across innovation is that we actually run what we call idea clinics. So these would be our clinics that our frontline staff would engage with us with regard to challenges that they may have. And obviously, you know, many of our staff have worked in the areas for a long period of time, and they actually know the challenges that patients have as well. And in many cases would have quite a clear idea of what the solution could be. So it's getting those ideas from the beginning and challenging them to actually progress it forward. So basically what we'd have then is a situation where they could end up that these could go into research. We may need to do some research on this, or there may already be a product out there that we can actually help them with to actually overcome that.
Okay.
So we work very closely with our academic partners and with industry to help work together towards that solution.
Okay.
With the patient at the centre. So it's quite unique to actually have an innovation sitting actually on the front line in the hospital to actually do that.
Brilliant. Dr. Natalie Cole, Head of Innovation at Tala University Hospital. Thanks very much, Natalie, for joining us this afternoon.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hardy.
Now, the increased focus on mental health in the last few years has seen more and more people turning to things like mindfulness, meditation and talking therapies to cope with stress. While these techniques are effective, it is important to remember that stress isn't all in your head and it can have a serious physical impact as well. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Alka Patel, who is the health activation doctor and also the longevity concierge. Good afternoon, Alka.
Hello, hello. Good to be here.
Brilliant names, I have to say, longevity concierge.
It's exactly what it says on the tin. We've all got to live our longest lives, right?
Absolutely. So you probably heard me in the intro there. Like, stress doesn't just affect your mind. A lot of people are carrying injuries or stresses all over their body.
Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't think there's a single part of your body that is not affected by stress. Not a single system.
So talk to us then about people who, you know, have stress in their body. You know, like, there's certain people, I'm a person now that when I'm stressed, my shoulders are like rocks, like complete and utter. I wake up in the morning, it's like my shoulders are up along my ears, you know. And I mean, I get, you know, you can rub it out yourself or whatever. But there's other people may have that in their back or maybe in their feet or whatever. Talk to us about that.
So when you think about it, this is what happens when your body is stressed, is that, of course, as you described, your muscles do tense up. It's a very reflex reaction to stress. And the reason it happens is it's your body being on guard. It's your way of guarding yourself against injury and pain. So when we do talk about stress, we often talk about it so negatively, don't we, as though it's something to completely avoid. But at its fundamental level, it's a really important protective response. But it's when it starts to become chronic, more intense, relentless, that it starts to affect us. So like you said, I'm sure many of us have experienced tension in our muscles. But then what happens is that tension, if you imagine it on the back of your neck, like your cervical area on the back of your neck, that then can result in headaches, which then become the intrusive thing that affects your focus and your ability to be productive in the day. And that can then become much more chronic. So something that starts off as stress or muscle tension, then resulting in chronic headache, is what becomes much more problematic.
Okay. Another big one then is people having stomach problems. And you often hear about this where, you know, someone suffers from maybe IBS or problems with their stomach. And again, they're under severe stress and they have stomach issues. Maybe they've, you know, they are physically sick. Maybe they have diarrhea, etc. What do you do in those situations? Like, how can you stop your body responding in that way? Or can you?
Yeah, so I think it's a really important thing that you've raised here is the connection between stress and gut issues. And even beyond that, there's a really strong gut-brain connection. I know earlier you were talking about the mind and mental health as well. And what stress does is it changes the barriers in your gut. So the bacteria that are supposed to stay out of your bloodstream potentially then end up in your bloodstream and then go into your gut and trigger what's called inflammation. So then that around the rest of your body affects parts that you might not even recognize. So it starts off in the gut as bloating and diarrhea can then result in much more long-term problems in terms of emotional health, physical health as well. And I think the first thing to recognize then is exactly that, is to recognize stress. So you mentioned you know it when you feel muscle tension. A lot of people have very different feelings, different symptoms, heart racing, feeling sweaty palms. And these are the sorts of things that are really important to be very mindful of, is your own body's stress response. Where is that stress showing up? Some it's the head, some it's the muscles, some it's the stomach. Be aware of that and then think back to what's the trigger? What's just happened here? What has triggered this response in my body? And I think once you put those things together, you can then start to change your response. But it's not easy. You know, I appreciate that we're living in very busy, very active lives. And I find one of the key things that I do, which is why I'm called the Health Activation Doctor Giver, is very much about looking at what information and signals are your body giving you and picking this up very specifically in terms of data. So there's one exciting thing I think would be really interesting to share here today, which is something called your heart rate variability, your HRV. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this, but this is a very, very good way of tracking and understanding how your body's responding to stress, because we all need to be very responsive and adaptive as humans. So your heart rate, everyone will know about. You can put your fingers on your pulse and count it away, but the really exciting thing is the pause between each heartbeat.
Okay.
And that pause tells you how you're responding to your day-to-day, moment-to-moment stress.
Okay. So are you saying that people, almost like maybe the way women might track their periods or their cycle, that people should be tracking when they get these triggers where their, you know, their stomach feels nauseous, or, you know, they're grinding their teeth, their muscles are tight, they're sweaty palms. We should take note of this and try and see what are our triggers, and whether it be a relationship or it be work or, you know, your hobbies, whatever, that we should try and hone in on that.
Oh, gosh, I'm so glad you're talking about this like this, because do you know how many signals our body is sending to us all the time? It's constantly trying to get us to attend to ourselves more. And if you notice those signals, then you're going to be able to respond to them. But what do? we tend to ignore them. Your stomach's calling out to you, you ignore it. The headache, you go and grab the ibuprofen or the paracetamol and you ignore it. The grinding of your teeth, the sleepless nights, you ignore it. And when you start to ignore these things over time, eventually your body's going to let out a really big shout and say, hello, diabetes, I'm here. Hello, cancer, I'm here. Hello, Alzheimer's, I'm here. So absolutely 100%. Is tune in. We just have to say tune in because the body is constantly giving us out signals. So my one plea to everybody listening is absolutely please don't ignore what might sound like quiet whispers that you can cover up and mask with a quick reach for a pill for every ill. It might feel like it's serving you in the short term, but the problem is what's happening in the long term.
Right. Okay. I have to say I would be very... prone to reaching for, you know, different types of things just because, you know, you kind of just get into a habit of saying, well, I have a headache, I'll take an ibuprofen or I have a headache, you know, a pain here or there. But when it comes down to if you do decide, right, I need to make a change, I constantly have a sore back or I constantly grind my teeth or have sweaty palms. Where do you go then? Like if you identify that perhaps it's your job or perhaps it's, you know, a friend of yours who no longer really is serving you friendship wise. Mm. Like, what do you do? Perhaps you can't leave your job. Maybe you have to stay on because you need the money.
Yeah, and these are important, crucial moments of decision, aren't they? They really are. And I hear this time and time again, and I find that the big problem is that people don't think about what can they do that's in their control, but what they end up doing is giving away control. So what I mean by that is really think about, you know, this stressful, this boss at work, for example, that's causing you stress and you need to stay on at work. Right, you've made that decision, but what are you going to do to then control your physiology, your biology? Because in that moment, you can immediately take control of your breathing. There's a huge connection between, say, your breathing rate and your stress response is very, very strong. And there's been quite a lot of research done around this, that if you simply slow down your breathing, and this is a magic number, so this is a good one to remember, you simply slow down your breathing to less than 6 breaths a minute, and you activate what's called your parasympathetic nervous system. So that's what I like to call P for parasympathetic, P for peaceful. And then you've immediately got control of that stress response. You're not going to let this harm your body, even though you've had to, for whatever reason, make that decision to stay on at work in the job that you're in. Or even with your friend, there may be a reason you can't let go of that relationship. But what can you do to take control of your physiology in that moment? So breath work is a very, very simple way. It's just one example, for example, of how you can take control of your health and prevent those long-term problems from showing up.
Okay, but I would imagine that your advice would be, Dr. Patel, that, you know, if you identify what is triggering or what is causing this extreme stress, like in terms of, like, if you always have tight shoulders or you always are clenching your jaw, grinding your teeth, that you would advise to make, like, bold life changes maybe to be less stressed going forward.
And you're absolutely right. I think we always have a choice point, don't we? Whatever we decide comes down to a choice. And even sometimes when it feels like I don't have a choice, I have to stay in this job, I have to stay in this relationship, I have to stay in this marriage, there is always a point of decision making. And it's thinking about how does this decision help me or how does this decision harm me? And it's very simple. I call this your choice point. Is it harming me or is it helping me? And really thinking clearly about what those goals in your life are and who you need to be present for you to achieve that, and how you're going to prioritize your health at the top of the tree in order to enable that. Because what I see time and time again is that health becomes the last thing. It falls to the bottom of the pile of things to do and things to prioritize because everyone else and everything else takes over. Mm. When you let your health become your big driver, then the decision-making is so much clearer as well.
Okay, I have a message in here. Obviously, a fan of yours, Dr. Alka, is an advocate for her innovative approach to health. She's great. That comes in from Justin McGurk. So there you go. A big fan here. I know you have a podcast as well, Alka, if people want to listen in.
Yes, I do. It's called Health Hacktivators, and I'll tell you the kind of premise behind Health Hacktivators, because I very much believe that we all should be taking ownership in terms of hacktivating our health. And there are so many things that we can do to not hand over, as you say, to the pills, but really to take charge of your own body and your biology. And hence the sort of podcast is called Health Hacktivators. So certainly tune into that. And I'm also on all the socials as well. So very happy for anyone to message me as well, Dr. Aquatel UK, and talk to me about their health. Stress is very rife. It's the next pandemic, or it's the current pandemic, or it's been around even before the last pandemic. It really has, hasn't it?
Brilliant. Yeah, it definitely has. I don't think there's anyone listening in here at the moment who hasn't been chronically stressed at one point or another, but hopefully they'll be able to listen to your podcast and they'll be stress-free going forward. Dr. Alka Patel, the health hacktivator doctor and longevity concierge. Thanks very much, Alka, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
No problem. That's all I have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.